January of 2015 was the worst month for stocks since January of 2014. Does this mean we should reconsider our investment strategies? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is off this week, so we lined up another financial expert to get her perspective on the turbulent stock market and to answer any questions you might have about managing your personal finances this year. If you have a question, we welcome it at 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Lauren Lyons Cole, a financial expert and personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Marketplace Money, and The Today Show. Her website is LaurenLyonsCole.com, and she joins us from the Argo Studios in New York City. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us. So,
thanks for having me.
Not a great month, January, a month to forget for many investors, with the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ all dropping a few percentage points. How concerned should we be about where the markets are today?
Well, certainly January was a volatile month. And, you know, one of the things to remember as an investor is that we hear the stock market increases 8% on average historically, but what we often forget is that very few years actually show an 8% gain. What we see are big swings, up 30, down 20. You know, that's the sort of year we can expect. And the thing is, we've had six positive years in a row. We don't know what 2015 holds. It might be year seven, it might not be. The better thing is to have a long-term perspective, know your goals, and just keep your money in the market.
Yeah, so we don't know just because the year started off shaky that it's going to end shaky.
Correct. I mean, there's no way to predict. And this is the challenge. You know, we want to make sure as investors that we're not selling because we're scared. And then, you know, if the market's up, then you've sold and now you're buying back in when the market's high. So it's better just to have a long-term perspective.
Yeah. In fact, if I remember correctly, the worst month since last month was January of 2014. And the end of December of 2014 was looking pretty good.
It was looking pretty good. And you know, just for point of an example, how many people would have predicted oil would drop as much as it has? So that it's a good reminder that we don't know what's ahead. And unless you're someone who's planning to retire at the end of this year or in the next couple years, for the rest of us, especially young people, you want to just stick to your asset allocation and to your investing plan.
Yeah, and I know that sometimes you do target some advice to millennials, and you say the group of people that should not be panicking right now is millennials. Are they bailing out of the stock market?
I think a lot of young people are shy. The stock market has not been very kind to millennials. And so whether or not they're bailing out, you know, if their parents listening or millennials listening, we want to make sure that they stay in the market, because a lot of millennials, they're going to be working until they're 70, I mean, or maybe older, who knows? That's 40 years away or more. And so millennials, more so than anyone else, have the time for stock market gains to recover. So even if this year is a low year, you still want to be maxing out your 401k or your IRA, doing as much as you can to contribute to retirement and keep it invested.
Yeah, what about those who are on the cusp of retirement, or for that matter, are retired? Should we be panicking?
So that when you're actually at the point of retirement, you do need to be a little bit more conservative when it comes to choosing your investments. And in that case, I think it's helpful to be working with a financial advisor to make sure that you're investing properly, because the other risk, of course, you don't want to lose money, but you also don't want to miss out on investment gains, which can impact you over the longevity of making withdrawals from your retirement account. So it's a fine balance when you get closer to retirement, and expert advice at that point can really be very valuable.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Lauren Lyons Cole, financial expert, personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com, and we welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, Lauren, while the 2015 is still young, it's still a good idea to run through some of the numbers that people should know about this year. What has changed in 2015 with regard to our 401ks?
Good news for 401k investors. We get a little bit extra of tax advantage savings in 2015. Now the maximum contribution is $18,000. And if you are over 50, you can make a catch-up contribution of $6,000. So it's a slight increase from 2014. IRA contributions, however, have remained unchanged. So we still have a max contribution of $5,500 for IRAs with $1,000 as the catch-up contribution. That's a lot of money, though. So a lot of good opportunities to set aside money for retirement for us in 2015.
Mm-hmm. Is there are there other areas that bring about, special considerations when it comes to 2015?
Well, for shock value, I can tell you that one projected estimated cost of college, if you've had a newborn child, if you have a young child right now, or if you have a young grandchild, the cost to send that child to a public university in 18 years is projected to be just under $100,000, about $95,000, which is a big number. Of course, it's just a reminder that in addition, of course, retirement comes first. That's the priority. But if you've got extra cash sitting around, investing in a 529 plan, which so far we're still getting all the tax benefits from, is really a good decision to be making right now, and making sure that that money is invested so you're on track to afford public university.
Yeah, this is not a political show necessarily, but the federal government is questioning whether there should be tax benefits to 529 plans.
You know, with the tax code is incredibly complicated. If there was a way to simplify it, we would all be better off and could understand our taxes better. And I think what was going on there, there's a lot of different ways that we get tax benefits when it comes to paying for college. So what I think President Obama was trying to do was to simplify it. And in fact, you know, it's not like he's trying to take away tax benefits. He's trying to make them easier. But this is an emotionally charged topic, and so it's one that needs to be very well explained and we got to tread lightly with it. But at this point, saving in a 529 plan is really what a lot of people are doing, and it's a good decision. But there's also tax credits. There's other ways that you can benefit from paying for college.
Well, we have a caller online. Richard in Milwaukee has a question. Hello, Richard.
Hello there.
Yes, what's your question?
Hi. I got a question about my 403B with the possibility of moving it over to my wife's IRA. And right now we're making 3% in my 403B. And my wife's IRA, I can get this security of income. That's where I have all my money now. And my wife and I, we discussed we wanted to keep my money in the 403B. In the security of income. And my wife, who's still working for 5 years, she has more stocks. So we decided for our security to keep my pension, my 403B in security of income. And her plan, I can move it into the IRA, and in fact we'd make 0.85% more. We still make more even by paying her transaction costs for the IRA. But here's the question I have. If IRA is not covered by the Employment Retirement Income Security Act, ERISA, and that ensures that money currently invested in a plan for the explicit purpose of retirement, my 403B, is protected from people who who may be indebted to, or I understand also, if you get sued, it's much harder to get that money out of the 403B. So here's the question. I can get more money by moving into my wife's IRA because they have a security of income plan too, but we're really worried about our money security. So
what advice might you have, Lauren?
Well, are you concerned, maybe this is too personal for the radio, but are you concerned about getting sued? Because if that's a...
Oh. No, not at all. No, not at all. But we're okay. really interested in security, securing that money.
Sure. So, you know, I totally understand, and I think keeping the money safe is important and something that we all want to do. But there is also this risk of not allowing the money to grow at a rate where you know that you're going to have a lifetime of income that you'll need during retirement. So, you know, that 0.85% extra really could make a difference, honestly.
Yeah.
Without seeing the actual investment details and what the fees are associated with, but if you're going to earn a little bit more, that could very well be worth it.
Yeah, it seems like it's a little complicated, Richard, to go into a lot more depth here, but I think it sounded like he was concerned that it wouldn't be protected by the Income Security Act if he transferred his 403B into an IRA, and you're not as concerned about that, Lauren.
No, it doesn't sound like something that he needs to be concerned about. But also, he's going to need to open his own IRA. You can't transfer. With retirement accounts, they stay in our own name. So his 403B can be rolled over into a new IRA that's in his own name, and it'll stay separate from his wife's, which is just kind of the way it works. But I think it's worth looking into, certainly.
Okay, we will take more questions from listeners and talk about some other issues, some personal finance issues that may affect you in 2015 when we return. We have with us Lauren Lyons-Cole. She is our financial guest during this edition of On Your Money. Our number, if you have a question for her, is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Take my $5. Take my shirts and collars. Take my heart that hollers.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley has this week off, but never fear, we have another financial expert to answer your money management questions. Lauren Lyons-Cole is with us, financial expert, personal finance contributor for TheStreet.com. Her website is laurenlyonscole.com. Our number, if you have a question, is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Steve in Middleton next. Hello, Steve.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I'm 63, probably going to work until at least 66 when full Social Security is. And I've got almost all my money invested in stocks because I had it in a target fund and was doing nothing but losing. So I thought, well, what the heck? Why not try to take advantage of it? So I'm wondering, the older financial advisors seem to want to start putting it into safer places further away from retirement. But your guest sounds like she's when she was introduced. Maybe 1, 2, or 3 years before you start being conservative with your money. What are her thoughts on that?
So this is actually an excellent question. And the way to answer it is actually to work backwards. So what we want to do is find out how much income you're going to need to generate from your savings during retirement on an annual basis. There's some great new calculators coming out that can help you with this. But if you're on track with your retirement savings and if you're pretty close to reaching the goal that you need to fully fund your retirement, then you can certainly start stepping it back, be more conservative. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you could start doing that at 40 if you really did a lot of savings and you were like on track for retirement somehow or won the lottery or whatever. But if you're at 63 and if you haven't quite reached your savings goals to fund your retirement, there's a few different things you can do. You can invest more aggressively. Like you said, keep the money in stocks. You could work a few extra years. You could downgrade your lifestyle. So it's really a matter of how much money do you need for retirement and how close are you to that goal? Now, moving your money into stocks probably worked out pretty well, especially over the past few years. But it could be, I mean, it's really about looking at how much money you need. So if you're very close to your goal, I would recommend going more conservative just to make sure that you don't end up losing the progress that you've made.
Are there any websites where you can do those calculators to kind of determine, at least the calculators will give you an idea of what they think you should need in retirement based on your habits today or what your income is today?
So here's a good rule of thumb. You can there are calculators, and honestly, they're from financial brands are the best ones that I've seen. So I don't know if I should be recommending specific. But if you Google retirement planning income, you should find some calculators. But as a rule of thumb, if let's just say, because I know these numbers off the top of my head, if you've saved $1 million, you can expect a yearly income from your savings only, not including Social Security or pensions or anything else, of $50,000 a year. So that's, you can kind of, you know, if you've got 600,000, you can kind of work backwards from there. But that's about a good rule of thumb is, and a million could also include the value of your home, because that's another great option of something you can sell and cash in on if at some point you need that money.
I have a question, Steve, for you, and maybe Lauren can also answer it. But when you said that you've been in these target date stocks and they've been losing, and you thought, what the heck, why not wait another 3 years? You think that they'll make up that lost ground?
Well, the target funds, you know, the target funds where you, if you say you're going to retire in 2020 or something, and so you throw your money in there and they automatically change the way the money is invested, they just didn't seem to be doing anything. And I've doubled my 401k since 08 just by being, you know, aggressive. And I put in 15, sometimes 20,000 a year into Roth IRA and 401k and Scottrade, just other places. And it's all been doing, you know, great. I'm more concerned about the fees I have to pay. Sometimes, like 401k, they charge over $1,000 a year just in management fees, and they do nothing for me other than hold my money and earn money for themselves. So
I agree with you more.
I want to see.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve. Anything to add there, Lauren?
Well, yeah, watching out for fees. Fees are exponential over time, and really that's something, you know, for especially the beginning of the year and you're thinking about your financial goals and looking over your documents, checking back in on those statements and looking closely at the fees. And if you're not sure what the fees are, making a phone call and finding out how much you're paying, that can really eat into your retirement money in the long run.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Lauren Lyons Cole during this edition of On Your Money. And we welcome any personal finance questions you might have on your mind today at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's talk a little bit more about retirement. You've written about high earners, and you said that they are at the greatest risk of having to downsize their lifestyle in retirement. Why would that be for high earners?
Yeah, this is a perfect segue. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, with high earners, I mean, everyone who's gearing up to pay for retirement, we're going to pull from different resources. We've got Social Security. If we're lucky, we've got a pension. We've got our 401k and other savings. We might have the value of our home that we can use if we need to. And the issue with people who are high earners, when they transition into retirement, they actually experience the biggest loss of income. So if you're someone who's making about $60,000 a year, for example, when you transition into retirement, more or less based on Social Security and pension averages and savings that you might have, you're not going to see a change in lifestyle. You're probably going to make right around the same amount in retirement. Now, if you were making $100,000 and you transition into retirement, the biggest impact on whether or not you're able to maintain your lifestyle will be your savings. And so when you're making more money, you have to save more money because you're going to, if you need to maintain that lifestyle when you get to retirement, you need to be able to take more out of savings. In fact, high earners end up making about 58% of their pre-retirement income once they transition into retirement. And that can be a big change for a lot of people.
So how reachable is a comfortable retirement today where we maintain our lifestyle and don't have to downsize or make major changes?
Unfortunately, if you're close to retirement, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and there's only so many changes you can make. But really a very good rule of thumb, and of course we've been saying this forever, is you save 15% over the course of 30 years. If you've got 40 years of employment, even better. But the more you save, the better likely you'll be to maintain your lifestyle. And I think, again, as we sort of were saying before, when you get, if you're 63 and you're looking at retirement, it's a few years away, and if you look at your account balances and see they are not going to cut it for your lifestyle, you'd be amazed at how much better off you can be by just deciding to work a couple extra years and saving aggressively during those years. A few more years of income rather than drawing down your savings can really have a positive impact on your overall retirement funding.
Self-employed people can choose from two popular retirement plans, according to some of your writing, SEP IRA and the Solo 401k. First off, what's a SEP?
So a SEP IRA, it's really the simplest way to save for retirement if you're self-employed. It's kind of an IRA. You know, it's very similar, but the contribution limits are much higher. For 2015, you can contribute up to $53,000, and that's calculated based on your income. So you may or may not be able to actually hit that maximum. But the SEP IRA is a great way. You know, the government, I think, understands that when you're self-employed, so anyone who is self-employed who's listening knows, some years are better than others. So some years you might have tons of extra money that you can throw towards retirement. And in other years, you know, times might be tight and you go on. But if you're an employee at a normal corporation, you can contribute $18,000 to a 401k. But the government gives self-employed people the opportunity in those very good years to sock away more money. And the SEP IRA is, you can open one at any firm, any brokerage firm, and it's very, very straightforward.
And the solo 401k?
So that's another strategy. Again, you can save $53,000 for 2015, same maximum contribution, but the way that that contribution is calculated is slightly different. So it's essentially as though you are the employer and the employee, which allows you to make the $18,000 401k contribution. But then in addition to that, you can also contribute a percent of your overall profit for the year. So it's a way to get, you can actually end up getting more money into the solo 401k if your income is lower than the SEP IRA.
So is that the determining factor, or how do you decide which one is right for you if you're self-employed?
If you know you're the kind of person who will only save money if it's very simple and easy, then I would say go for the SEP IRA because it's the lowest barrier to entry. You're most likely to be able to, you know, make that one happen. The solo 401k, there's more paperwork, there's a bit more fees. But if you're behind on retirement savings, and if you're doing pretty well as a self-employed person but not, you know, super well, then a solo 401k is going to allow you to set aside more money. So it's a little bit more effort up front. But if you're really trying to jumpstart your retirement savings or play catch up, then that's going to be the best option. And either one of them you can open at a brokerage firm.
Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, we will talk to Lauren about some advice on when cutting corners doesn't pay. But in the meantime, we'll take many more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Hart in Delavan. Hi, Hart. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Lauren. Question I have, similar to the previous caller, I'm in my early 60s, and I'm primarily invested in stocks and mutual funds consisting of stocks. The rule of thumb is, as you get closer to retirement age, you should be moving money into bonds. But if I look at the forecast, bond rates are going to rise. So if I'm buying bonds now, won't I be losing money?
Well, again, it really depends on what your goals are. I mean, if your retirement funding is not quite where it needs to be, then you might need to stay in stocks no matter what. Bonds typically are safer than the stock market, and so it is a more conservative choice. But in recent years, you know, that's up for debate. So again, it's very hard to predict what's going to happen in 2015. And the key is making sure that you have the income you need to fund your retirement. And if that isn't there, then you need to stay aggressively invested, regardless of what the predictions are for the year, to make sure that you're reaching those goals or to make sure that you have the chance to reach those goals.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Hart. Next, we'll go to Bob in Madison. Hello, Bob.
Hello. I am looking, trying to figure out when to start taking Social Security. I know I'm 63 right now. If I started now, I'd get a certain amount. If I waited till 66, I'd get more. If I waited till 70, I'd get more. So I made up a chart. If I waited till 70, I would be losing all the money I would have gotten between now and then, of course. So I made up a chart as to when I would break even. And I just want to know if I'm looking at this correctly. If I start right now, if I start at age 66 compared to starting now, I wouldn't break even until age 77. And if I start at age 70, I wouldn't break even until age 80. Are there other factors I should be considering?
No, actually, it sounds like you're right on track with that. So, and that's about right for most people, is the 77 to 80 range there. I was actually going to say 78 is the break even. So it sounds like you're looking at the specific details based on your situation. And that's a really good way to decide when you're going to take Social Security. Of course, if you absolutely need it now, if you've been laid off for some reason, or if you need to start taking it, then by all means do. But for a lot of people, especially healthy people, waiting can make a very big difference on funding retirement, on the lifestyle you're able to afford. So, look into your health and the longevity of your family members, your parents, and make that decision. Of course, it's very personal. But for most people, waiting, if you can wait, works out very well.
Yeah. But I think maybe I was misunderstanding about, but I think what he was saying to some extent was, why not take it early? Yeah, it's going to be a couple hundred dollars less per month, but he'll be collecting that check every month until he's 70. And maybe then if he waits until he's 70 and then starts collecting, while it might be a few hundred dollars more per month, he's only going to live a little while longer.
Well, I mean, my great-grandmother lived to be 103, so I always plan to live to be, like, you know, over 100. And of course, everyone's different, but if you are going to have a very long life, the longer you wait to take Social Security is very good for a few reasons. A big reason is that Social Security is tied to inflation. So it's inflation-adjusted, guaranteed income, hopefully guaranteed, and that can really make a difference. We're talking about the stock market going up and down, bonds, interest rates changing. The one thing you can count on is that Social Security is going to be tied to, you know, the rising inflation. You can't guarantee that out of a 401k. So there's a lot of benefits to having a larger Social Security check over time, especially if you're, you know, if you come from a healthy stock.
Yeah, but if it means that between the ages of, let's say, Bob 63 and 70, that he's going to be kind of scrimping and scraping and having not maintaining his lifestyle, he should take it?
You know, there's a lot of other – besides – listen, most mm-hmm. people do take Social Security early. So if you end up doing that, that you're with the majority. But there are so many other ways that you can fund your lifestyle. I mean, even getting – an encore career, doing some sort of extra job, to have anything that you can do to delay taking Social Security if you think you're going to live a long time will definitely work out better in the long run. But most people do need to take it early. And sometimes, and for anyone who's younger, who's thinking about this maybe in their 40s, having a good plan for your career and knowing that you're in a job or that you transition into a job that you can work in up until 70. Many of us are going to have to work until we're 70. So you want to start doing that planning well in advance if you can.
Mm-hmm. Okay, could Bob?
That's good advice. Thank you. And could I ask you, why do they call age 66 full retirement age?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure that I actually know the answer to that, but I think it just is because of the great financial responsibility of funding Social Security. I could be wrong, but
yeah, we'll look that up. It seems to me that it's called full retirement age because it was legislatively raised to age 66 to get the, you know, the full retirement benefits through Social Security at that age. But we'll
and that age is going to continue to increase, and so that's why it's important to really, if you're younger, to plan on working longer because we're going to have to.
All right, thanks, Bob, for the call. Let's go to Bill in Madison next. Hello, Bill.
Hello. Just, I think, a quick one. You were talking about the importance of
of watching the fees that you pay for a financial advisor. And our question is, two questions really. What terms can, you know, what sort of kind of arrangement can you have with these people, and what sort of fees should you be expecting to pay? What is reasonable in the marketplace?
This is one of my favorite topics. So when you're looking at the amount of fees that you're paying to a financial advisor, you want to make sure, I mean, a very standard amount, many advisors will charge 1% of the amount of assets, the size of your portfolio that they're managing. And that's accepted as reasonable. That is changing largely, though. Many more advisors are coming in and technology is offering ways to manage our portfolio for much cheaper than having a person looking over it. But if many people are more comfortable working face-to-face with an individual, so I understand that. So 1% is the max, right? And if you can get anything lower than that, and oftentimes financial planners will negotiate with you. The one thing that I want to really emphasize is that if you're working with an advisor who is not a certified financial planner, who is not a, you know, doesn't have some sort of designation that really shows that they've studied, that they've passed an exam, that they're very well qualified to look at your comprehensive financial situation, not just your investments, but also your insurance planning, your estate planning, all these other things that are very important to your financial situation as well, then you might be overpaying for what you're getting, because just recommending a mutual fund is not very hard to do. You can go, in fact, you could call a brokerage firm and get their customer service representatives are pretty much just as well trained to recommend a mutual fund and will not charge you a fee. So many financial advisors do earn money by selling mutual funds and getting a commission. You know, and everyone has to make a living, but it's important for you as a consumer to understand the fees that you're paying. Those commissions can be up to 6%. And if that's too much eating into your bottom line, then you need to look elsewhere. And there are many places online right now where you can get advice, even for free. There's a new thing called Intelligent Portfolios that came out from one of the big investment firms, and they will help you create an entire well-diversified portfolio for 0% management fee, which to me is exciting, and I hope this is the way of the future. I think consumers need cheaper fees when it comes to managing their financial products.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. That's the Schwab Intelligent Portfolio?
Yes.
And so if people are interested in that, you go to Schwab and you can read more about it, or what?
Correct. It just launched. It's brand new. And so the way that Schwab is going to make money on this, of course, is they're going to recommend exchange-traded funds, ETFs, that are branded by Schwab. So there will be an expense ratio, a carrying cost that you will pay to Schwab for those ETFs, but you're going to pay that no matter where you are. So if you're at any of the large firms, any mutual fund, there's always an expense ratio that you're going to be paying. The thing that really, and with expense ratios, you want that number to be under 1%. The Schwab ETFs are well under 1%, so that's fine. The big advantage here is that you're not paying an additional management fee on top of the fees for the funds, because those can really add up, and then you end up paying, you know, you could be paying as much as 3% of your money every single year, which is exponential over time, towards all these financial fees. So, yeah, the Schwab Intelligent Portfolios, I hope that it's the way of the future. I think a lot of other firms are going to have to get on board and offer similar plans.
All right. Thanks, Bill, for the call. Good luck. Kate in Elm Grove is next. Hello, Kate.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had a question that was prompted by what your guest said earlier about 401ks, and it almost sounded like you felt that they were really not worth going into. And the one comment I have is the ones that I have left with my former employers have performed very well. And one of the employers I had kind of just not paid any attention to it, and I was organized. We're both retired, and I was organizing how much money we have and where it was coming from. And so I called them and said, you know, I haven't looked at this for a while. Can you tell me how much I have? And the young lady said, sure.
And then you picked yourself off the floor because it was so high, Kate?
Yeah. Mm. I made a little gasping sound and went into a happy dance.
Well, so I missed that, Lauren. Are you anti-401k?
No, I'm glad that you called and clarified that. I'm not sure what I said to imply that, but maybe it was along the lines of the man who wanted to transfer his 403B to an IRA. And here's the thing, actually, you raise a very good point, which is that women tend to be better investors, and the reason is women tend to ignore their investments. And, you know, if you – which – can backfire if you put your money into a savings account and it's just getting, you know, less than 1% interest every year. But if you're in a 401k or an IRA or some sort of investment account and you invest the money and then you go back to living life and focus on the other things that you have going on, this can really happen. You 10, 20 years later, you find out, oh, this has increased greatly, which is encouraging and important to hear those sort of stories, especially when we've had such a volatile month in January. And so leaving your money invested and forgetting about it can really pay off in the long run.
It's the secret to my somewhat success, ignoring my investments. We are talking about our investments and much more. When we come back, we have room for many more of your personal finance calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. But we will also talk about when cutting corners may not pay off. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, I'm Joy Cardine with Lauren Lyons Cole. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with financial expert Lauren Lyons Cole during this edition of On Your Money. Our regular financial guru, Kevin McKinley, will be back next week. Lauren, you were quoted in a recent story on Yahoo Finance about how cutting corners in an effort to save money can actually hurt us. How could shopping on the sales rack and getting my stuff 50% off be a bad thing?
Right. You know, it's funny because when we're buying things on sale, we tend to congratulate ourselves and think, oh, look, you know, look at this great sweater I got for $15. And that's okay. Obviously, buying things on sale, that's great if it's something that you actually need. And what I like to recommend, actually, what I do myself is I keep an ongoing list on my smartphone so that I know what sort of things am I shopping for. And if I find those things on sale, then great, I'm going to buy them. However, stores know that if they offer a sale, that's a way to get us in the door. And they know that once we're in the door, we're likely to buy other things as well. And in fact, 9 out of 10 Americans impulse shop, and to the tune of about $200 a month. And I think any of us who have ever walked into, you know, a big box store and been meaning to buy one thing and then come out with like bags of other things, it happens to the best of us. So, but that $200 a month, if we could put that towards an IRA or towards our 401k over time, that's going to make or towards a 529 plan. I mean, that's big money over time.
Does this happen to you, Lauren? I sometimes go to the, you know, department store, and I see that there's a big sale going on, and I'm looking around the sales rack, but I won't find anything I like on the sales rack, and then I'll pay full price for some item I like.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and that's what stores expect. In fact, Black Friday is a great example of this because they have all these doorbuster deals. But unless you're lining up this past year on Thanksgiving Day to be, you know, the first 10 people in the store, you're not actually getting those good deals, but you're already in the store and you've gone to so much effort and there's so many other people, you're going to buy stuff. So, you know, it's one of these things that we don't always think through. But really, I mean, it can make a huge difference on your budget.
Yeah. So are there other areas where, you know, cutting corners, trying to, you know, save is actually a bad idea?
One of the biggest things that people don't think about, if you're carrying a credit card balance, if you've got debt on your credit card that you haven't quite paid off, a lot of people think that it's a good idea to do a 0% balance transfer. And if you're working on a debt repayment plan and if you've really thought through it and used a calculator and you know how much money you can pay towards your debt each month, that can work out really well. But for a lot of people, you end up rolling over part of your balance. Sometimes you can't roll over the entire balance because you can only transfer $1,000 or $2,000 to the 0% APR card. And then there's a transaction fee on that amount, so you're paying some degree of money to move the money over. And then once the 0% intro rate expires, oftentimes that that interest rate will skyrocket. It might be higher than what it was on the original card. So over time, you can end up actually paying more when you think you're doing the right thing by rolling over your money.
Yeah. Well, now that I'm a homeowner, I certainly have to carry home insurance. But when I was a renter, I didn't. I confess, when I didn't have a whole lot of money. But that's a bad idea too, to skip renter's insurance.
You know, renter's insurance is one of the cheapest insurances out there. I mean, you can get coverage for like $15 a month, $30 at most. And it's about more than just your stuff. So if you're young and you've got an apartment full of IKEA furniture or whatever, you might not think your stuff is valuable enough to replace it. But renter's insurance offers a few other benefits as well. For instance, liability insurance, in case you're having a party and someone trips and falls because it's icy and you know, it's someone that you didn't know and they end up suing you. The renter's insurance is going to provide a degree of liability coverage, and they're also going to provide coverage if something like a fire happens or damage, water damage from a neighbor. If something else happens and you can't live in your apartment, that $15 a month could translate into you getting put up in a hotel or some sort of temporary living space on the insurance bill. So you don't actually have to pay for it. So renter's insurance is a great idea when you're young, even though it's something we often overlook.
And speaking about buying that house, you say that buying a home with less than 20% down is another trap.
It can be, yeah. I mean, it always depends on your situation. So there are many benefits to buying a home, of course, and sometimes it's worth it to do it if you don't quite have 20% saved. But 20% down payment is this threshold between whether or not you're going to have to pay private mortgage insurance. So if you have less than 20% to put towards purchasing your home, 20% down, then you're going to pay an extra 0.5% to 1% on the balance of your mortgage each year for the privilege of buying a home for what the bank would deem, you know, less than the ideal down payment. And that can add up over time. I mean, it can end up being, if you have a $300,000 mortgage, it's about $3,000 per year until you get to 20% equity in your home. And if that, you know, that $3,000 per year, again, if you put it into a 529 plan or into an IRA or a 401k and invested it appropriately, over time, I mean, over 6 years, that could grow to be $23,000 in an account instead of just money that you've given to the private mortgage insurance company.
I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money. We are talking with Lauren Lyons Cole, and we welcome any personal finance questions that you might have for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones. Jeff in Appleton is with us now. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. I have a question about waiting till age 70 with Social Security. I'm 65 right now, and I'm real tempted to wait till 70. My only concern is, you know, you hear about the possibility of maybe them, you know, through legislation and because of the health of Social Security, that they might be cutting back the benefits down the road, and say that they maybe they cut it down by 20% or so, and by the time I'm age 70, it's a worse deal waiting than starting now. Can you comment anything on that whole situation?
Well, I mean, this is definitely, I think, a concern for all of us. It's really hard to predict. It's, if anything, this is harder to predict than the stock market for the year. But I do think that Social Security is going to be around. And regardless of if they cut back on benefits, if you've waited until 70, you're still going to end up with more than if you had started taking it. I mean, if they're cutting back, they're going to cut back on everyone. So you might as well be starting from a higher point. And, you know, if you're married, there are a lot of different planning strategies you can do to try to maximize the benefit that you get over the course of your lifetime. So if you're 65 now, I think it's a really good time to, you know, there are websites that you can look at and understand the resources. You might be able to talk to a Social Security expert. I still really think for most people that waiting is the best decision.
Ken in Ashland is with us now. Hello, Ken.
Hello. I'm wondering, if a person is at age 58 looking to retire within the next 2 to 3 years, has been in the Wisconsin retirement system for over 35 years, has dollars put away from that pension, has a 401k with about $250,000 in, and also has an agreement with his employer for a post-benefit retirement option of 5 years of paid health and dental insurance after retiring. What is it that a person should be doing in terms of guaranteeing for themselves that they will not have a decrease in their lifestyle once they retire?
Well, that, I mean, sounds like you've got a really good situation, actually. And it, to me, just, and you know, listening to some of those numbers, it sounds like you're not going to have to change your lifestyle. But you can actually do the specific math and find out for sure by looking at what is that pension payment that you'll get each month, what sort of taxes are you going to have to pay, looking at your Social Security, understanding that that $250,000 that you have set aside for, in you know, to supplement your savings, how much of that do you need to draw down per year? And of course, you won't have to start taking it out until you're 70 and a half. So you could leave it, let it continue to grow. And the health insurance deal sounds pretty good too. So another question would be, is your home paid off? Do you own your home outright? That can make a huge difference. But it sounds like you're going to be in pretty good shape, actually.
Thanks, Ken, for the call. Well, let's spend a little bit of time on three new apps that that you say are pretty decent and we should consider if we want to save some money. What are the three apps?
Okay, I got to say I'm really excited about this one. It's an app. It's also a website, so people who aren't into apps can try this on their computer. It's called Hopper, and it's a travel app, sort of like Kayak or Expedia. But the great thing about Hopper, so from a personal finance point of view, is they do reports on every flight path that you could be pursuing. In fact, I'm actually going from New York to Florida this weekend, and I was able to look at Hopper and see that I got a really good deal on my airfare. But if I had known about Hopper before I booked it, I could have looked and seen what is a good deal on the route that I'm flying. And so I really recommend that if you're planning a trip so you can make sure that you're getting the best possible price.
Cool.
Really helpful.
Yeah. I'm gonna look that up. And then there are a couple others.
Fovato is another good one, a great way to save on groceries. It's very easy. They're, you know, couponing takes a lot of time, especially clipping all the coupons. So with Fovato, their users say that they're able to, extreme coupon type people, but it's for the everyday person. Anyone can use this. But you can take 4 hours of clipping coupons and achieve the same savings with just 10 to 15 minutes on the app scrolling through the available coupons and saving them to your phone. So that's a really good option if you're trying to save at the grocery store, but you don't have the time or energy to put into couponing.
I like it. And then you have a third as well.
So this one is more about saving time, and it's something that I think is really interesting, more for a forward-looking point of view. It's an app called TLDR, which is internet slang. It's like what the young kids are saying, stands for too long, didn't read. And they're trying to retrain us to write shorter emails so that it's more like text messaging. So we're not spending so much, you know, email is a electronic thing. We don't have to write really long emails. And so by emailing more efficiently, it gives us more time to do other things. For instance, looking for coupons or trying to save on travel or working harder and putting our energy into more productive and income earning opportunities. So I'm interested in that app too.
Sounds great. I'm going to check them out. Thank you so much, Lauren, for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Joy. It's always a pleasure.
Lauren Lyons-Cole is a financial expert, personal finance contributor to thestreet.com. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Market Place Money, and The Today Show. Her website is laurenlyonscole.com. Kevin McKinley will be back on Your Money next week. I'll be off, and John Munson will be on for me. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.